Welcome to the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review, where we cover all things national security, military, foreign policy, and history. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Olivia C., and we'll be interviewing today's guest, Mr. Edward Chow, to talk about European energy security amidst Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Edward Chow is a senior associate in the Energy Security and Climate Change Program at CSIS. He is an international energy expert with 40 years of experience, where he's worked in Asia, the Middle East, Africa, South America, Europe, Russia, and the Black Sea and Caspian regions. He has developed government policy and business strategy while advising governments, international financial institutions, major oil companies, and leading multinational corporations. He has successfully negotiated multi-billion dollar oil and gas agreements and specializes in investments in emerging economies. Chow spent 20 years with Chevron Corporation in headquartered and overseas assignments, including head of international external relations and country manager in China. He has published articles in leading academic and foreign policy journals on global energy developments. He's spoken on energy at international conferences, universities, and think tanks in the United States, Europe, Asia, and South America, and has appeared on major international media. Mr. Chow, thank you so much for being here today to discuss such a relevant topic such as energy security in Europe amidst the Russia-Ukraine war. So before we jump into things, I'd like to provide a brief overview of the past 9 months. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in late February 2022, the U.S. and Western allies have responded by providing Kyiv with tools and equipment to defend its sovereignty, increasing NATO troop presence on the eastern flank, and implementing sanctions that include targeted sanctions against Kremlin leadership and companies, important export restrictions related to cutting-edge technology, oil refining equipment, dual-use goods, and crude oil, and the removal of Russian banks from the SWIFT system. We've observed the West really work together through NATO to support Ukraine's sovereignty, and the European Union has worked to decrease its dependence on Russian petroleum. However, we've seen Russia pivot and increase its exports to Turkey and Asia, specifically China and India, and we continue to read about reports of human rights violations committed by Russian troops. Recently, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff suggested that around 40,000 civilians have died due to this conflict, and 200,000 Ukrainian and Russian soldiers have been killed or wounded, which begs the question, Mr. Chow, what were the goals and what are the goals of the U.S. and allied sanctions, specifically petroleum-related sanctions, and have they achieved what they sought to achieve?
Well, those are very interesting questions. I think one way of thinking about it is to say that if the objectives are to first stop the war, in other words, stop Russia's attack on Ukraine and its brutality and atrocious behavior in Ukraine, then economic sanctions, energy sanctions in particular, were always the second best solution, that it would never have the immediate impact that policymakers may have sought. In reality, in a war, there is no substitute for hard military response. And I'm saying this mindful that this is a security studies podcast. We learned that with Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which was sanctioned by the global community, but ultimately it took hard military power if the objective is to overthrow the Saddam Hussein regime. Exactly the same thing with Muammar Gaddafi's Libya. So economic sanctions by themselves were never designed or should have been expected to have immediate impact if the objective is to stop the fighting. Hard military power of the sort, like a no-fly zone over Ukraine, so that Russia wouldn't have air superiority. We should have known then, we now know was key, which is why we're supplying Ukraine, I would say belatedly, with Western air defense systems now, rather than at the beginning of the war. The West declared, and perhaps for good sound reasons, the alliance declared that they were not going to take any steps like a no-fly zone for the fear of escalating and expanding the war beyond Ukraine. I understand that. So if economic sanctions was the second best option of either trying to end the war by drying up Russia's oil and gas income, or punish Russia, or to make Russia understand that they won't be allowed to win this war, then it was going to take time. It's going to take many months, if not years, to achieve its objective. Energy sanctions was, once you decide that economic sanctions was the tool of choice, energy sanctions was the obvious place to look at, because Russia derives most of its export earnings from oil and gas exports. You're going to hurt Russia economically. Oil and gas was the clearly the place to look. Oil is much easier to sanction from a European perspective because oil is easier to replace Russian supply. Gas is much more difficult. So one of the predictable things that happened is that the Europeans sanctioned Russian oil, and therefore Russia decided to play the gas card, which is much more difficult for Europe to handle. So, you know, I think if the objective is to signal Western resolve in supporting Ukraine, Western unity, then economic sanctions in some ways has demonstrated that, right? Solid support that Ukraine is getting from the West in that area. But it was never designed to work quickly. And unfortunately, we see the fighting and the brutality continue, of course.
That's really interesting, especially as seems like we sometimes look, or policymakers sometimes look, for quick fixes or solutions to hard problems. How long do you think it would take for these sanctions to achieve their objectives or to affect the Kremlin's calculus with this war?
Well, I'm hoping the war would end sooner than that. and therefore, I'm in my view, and I've done a lot of work in Ukraine. I've worked on Ukraine in the Ukraine's energy sphere for more than 20 years. So I have a lot of Ukrainian friends, you know, good connections in Ukraine. So I really hope that the war ends with either Ukrainian victory or Russia finally understanding that it won't be able to achieve any of its military objectives in Ukraine, and it's better off stopping. And the way to do that is really military victory on the ground. And so I think the recent emphasis on supplying Ukraine with the tools it needs to defend itself is the right thing to do. What I'm more concerned about is that we're either going to reach a war of attrition where both sides continue to suffer, mainly Ukraine, of course, because the war is being fought on Ukrainian soil, or we have a stalemate, which leads to the risk of the battlefront opening again anytime. So we may have a pause, but not the permanent fix that we may want. Now, does energy play, this question, a role in that? Maybe, but not soon enough, I would say. I mean, part of the problem is that the supply response to a energy shock takes a long time because of the nature of the oil and gas industry. So Russia exported more than 7.5 million barrels per day to a roughly 100 million barrels per day market globally. So you can't take off 7.5% of global supply and not see a price impact. So the fear is that this tightening sanctions would actually collapse the global economy. So this is a fine line that policymakers have to walk. And I don't think they've found that right combination yet.
And I think that brings me to my next question about alliances, right? Because when we talk about the implications of sanctions on the European economy or on certain countries in the EU. How could that affect alliances as this war continues on, as there's discussions of a price cap, which we can get into? But how do you see that affecting the alliance through the winter and potentially into the spring?
Well, I think it's concerning. I think there's a very good chance that Europe will go into a recession this quarter before the end of this year. I was just in Germany a few weeks ago at the end of October. And the question you ask is, would alliance unity stick if European population starts suffering because their utility bills are high, or they can't get enough heat in the wintertime. Factories may be closing. There may be layoffs because of the energy shortage. I think that's a very good question. The immediate impact, of course, of since the war started on February 24th, or this phase of the war started on February 24th, is that Europeans are concerned about their own security. That we don't stop Russia here in Ukraine, then where wouldn't that ultimately jeopardize our own security, border security, and so on? That is felt particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, in a country like Poland, for example. So they are all the Baltics, and so they're willing to suffer a certain amount of economic pain to stop Russia now, rather than have to face Russia 5 years down the road or sometime later if Russia would be allowed to prevail in Ukraine. But if you're sitting in Portugal, do you feel the same way? If you're sitting in Spain, do you feel the same way? If you're sitting in Italy, that will be tested this winter. So, as I said, the combination of the trade-offs, if you will, the economic trade-offs between what the policy objectives are and the economic consequences of extending, prolonging sanctions, we will see. It will be tested this winter and beyond. This winter may be a mild winter. I mean, so far it's been a mild winter in Europe, so we may get lucky, but this is going to extend for a long time. The analogy that I draw is when I was a young person like you today, went through the two oil price shocks of the 1970s. People talk about the Arab oil embargo of 1973. The Arab oil embargo lasted 5 months. This war, as you just said, is 9 months old, and we have no idea when it's going to end or how it's going to end. So the potential impact may be even longer lasting than the oil price shocks of the 1970s.
And when you think about the price shocks of the 1970s, even if this war ended tomorrow, what are the implications of these shocks on the U.S. economy, the European economy, in the upcoming months? We just talked about a recession. How does the oil and gas market play into that?
Well, here I think you have to add not only the price shock, but our stated climate transition, energy transition objectives as well. So in the short run, we need more energy, right? Because we're missing part of the Russian energy flows into Europe. But in the long run, we also want to have energy transition away from the kind of fossil fuels that Russia exports, or gas, coal. And so that's a difficult finesse that we, you know, in the short run, we need more fossil energy, if you will, to keep factories running, to keep homes warm, people can buy petrol to get to work, so on. But in the long run, we also want to have an energy transition. And what I'm concerned about is where the policymakers are making the right choices right now in terms of policies. One thing I've detected is that policymakers seem to be losing trust in the market, finding the solution. So in Europe, for example, they're talking about a price cap on natural gas or electricity. while you put a cap on price and electricity, you may not get the conservation efficiency improvement that you want. And it may lead to higher consumption than otherwise if you allow the oil prices to float up or energy prices to go up. I understand politicians' motivations why, because of the impact on the consumer and their voters, but it may have long-term consequences that are not so good to contemplate. In the United States, President Biden drew oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves, mainly to dampen gasoline prices, without a physical oil supply shock yet. And the question is this a good idea or not? Partly because we don't trust markets to offer the best solution. And that may become a problem if it continues. One of the bad lessons learned from the 1970s oil shock was that the United States put on wage and price controls. In the 1970s under two Republican administrations, Nixon and Ford's, which led to what your grandparents and your parents might remember as gasoline lines, people wanting to make sure that the car is full of gas and therefore people are stocking up on gas. So if you have price control, then what you end up with is shortages in the long run. The reason I say that climate change policy also enters into the picture is because at the same time, we're telling ourselves that we're going to transition away from fossil fuels. So if you're a fossil fuel producer and you're in the long-term capital-intensive business, how do you justify investing a dollar today that you may not see back until 5 to 10 years from now, when the government says that we won't need as much fossil fuels anymore, right? So you're not maybe not getting the investment into a longer term supply response to the cutoff of Russian oil and gas. So, you know, this is going to be a dilemma. And are we smart enough to learn from the lessons of the past and in order not to repeat them? It took President Carter in 1978 to decontrol natural gas prices in the United States. And President Carter and Reagan in 1980 decontrol oil prices in the United States. If they hadn't done that, the United States would never have had the shale gas revolution or the shale oil revolution, which, by the way, we got 25, 30 years later. So there's a big lag. I mean, which is the problem between long-term policymaking in energy, which is a long-term industry, and the short-term political imperatives. And getting that mix right is really tricky and not so easy to do.
Thank you for that. And I think one question that comes up then is we're lacking refining capability. In the United States and elsewhere. So does this climate change policy that you're discussing affect refinery decisions here?
Absolutely. Because again, it's a long-term capital intensive business. So who's going to invest billions of dollars to build new refineries or upgrade existing refineries, expand existing refineries, if the government says, well, we're not going to need them later, right? Because you're never going to get the financial return that you were hoping for, which takes 20, 25, 30 years through the life of these projects to recoup your costs and make some kind of decent return. So people won't be investing in refining capacity as long as the policy is to transition away from fossil fuels. On the other hand, the people who are climate advocates say, well, don't expand the refineries, because once you expand the fossil fuel consumption system, then it will be locked in. We won't be able to move away from fossil fuels because you have this locked in investment, and then we will continue to pollute the atmosphere for the next 30, 40 years. So there's a tension there as I said before, between the short-term imperatives and the longer-term goals. And getting that mix right is becoming more and more complicated. It would have been complicated anyway without the war. The war just, you know, magnifies everything to a point where we now understand the scale, the magnitude much better than we did before, which by itself is not a bad thing, because we have to face reality that the energy transition may take longer than people think, unless people are willing to use a lot less energy than their, you know, living standards and lifestyles afford them today, then we're going to have this problem going through the transition without a very bumpy ride.
So circling back to the price cap idea, the news is reporting on December 5th, there's the potential that the G7 will implement the price cap on Russian oil. Can you explain what that is, what the goals of it are, and if you think it'll be successful?
Well, I can't explain what it is because we don't have a lot of details on what it actually is. I think I understand what the goals are. I think the U.S. Treasury Department in particular was concerned in the spring of Europe talking about a outright ban on Russian oil and extending to shipping of Russian oil and insurance on the shipping of Russian oil. Because I think understandably, the Treasury Department is thinking if you take all Russian oil out of the market, we're going to have $150+ oil rather than at that time, $120 oil that we were seeing in the spring. So it was pretty clear what would happen to the global economy if that were to happen. And so they were trying to think of a better option than an outright ban. So I think I understand what the objective is. My problem is that mechanism that they may be talking about would be very cumbersome to enforce, and I'm not sure how realistic it would be. Let's face it, oil will always move at the right price. And again, throughout history, we should have learned that when the United Nations had an oil embargo on South Africa, but somehow apartheid South Africa in the 60s and 70s, and somehow oil always managed to reach South Africa. Because at the right price premium or the right price discount, oil will always move. And we know that with sanctions on Saddam Hussein and others. So I think the price cap idea is to try to force Russia to provide the maximum price discount in order to move their barrels, but not to take Russian barrels off the market altogether. In order to lower the revenue that Russia gets from its oil exports. My problem with it is I don't see how it can be enforced, and it would be very cumbersome. And we still don't have details. We don't even have details on what the oil price dollar cap would be. And so it has created a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace without actually achieving the objectives. Oil prices today are at about $90 per barrel. Oil prices before talk of the war started at the beginning of last December was below $70. So today there is about a $20+ premium on what was the previous oil price. That allows Russia today to discount its oil and more or less get the same income. Or a little bit less, but not as much less. So if you set a price cap that is below that, then maybe Russia would have to discount its oil even more in order to move it to Turkey or China or India. If that's the objective, if that's the thinking, you know, I have a much better, more elegant proposal that I put on the table in writing in the middle of June to head off what I was concerned about the G7 leaders meeting in Germany at the end of June that would endorse the price cap idea. And my idea is to put a import tariff on Russian oil that the West can unilaterally impose on imports of Russian oil to Europe or the United States, and that effectively would force Russia to offer a discount to everyone else, because you know there's no reason for China to pay any more than the Russian price net the Western import tariff. That would have been much easier to enforce. It doesn't require us to force other countries to do what they don't want to do. But unfortunately, that has not received much traction. I do have a concern that the price cap idea has been floating around for a long time, and yet we still don't have any details. The G7 leaders at their summit in Germany at the end of June endorsed the idea. The finance ministers of the G7 said they were going to work urgently on it. When they met, I believe in September, just a few weeks ago, the foreign ministers of the G7 said that their details will be revealed soon. December 5th is just around the corner. And so no doubt there will be a grace period of some sort if and when they finally release the details. My concern is that if we announce that the Western Alliance announced a policy that then turns out to have not the same punch that we had hoped, then we would be seen as feckless and incompetent in the way we execute policy, which is exactly the wrong signal you would want to send to Vladimir Putin.
So is your idea with tariffs on Russian oil that because you're keeping oil on the market and only willing participants will actually implement the tariffs, that it keeps demand as is and can lower the cost of oil, preventing Russian oil revenues? Or can you explain how it works?
Well, that would be the desired outcome. Whether you get that or not is not a guarantee. So let me give you an example based on prices today. Let's say, let's assume the price is around $90 today. And I put a $40 per barrel import tariff on imports of Russian oil to the West. So instead of $90, Russia only gets $50. Right. So if you're India and you know that Russia only gets $50 if they export to Europe, which is closer, by the way, than India is to Russian ports, right? Then if you're India, you may have to pay a slight premium over the $50 price, but there's no reason why you need to pay more than $51, right? And that is still much lower than what Russia is getting from India today. That's the idea. And I would dedicate the tariffs collected for Ukrainian humanitarian relief, which is, you know, much needed, as well as future reconstruction. So I would put that money aside for Ukraine to compensate for the damages that the war has done to Ukraine. And Russia has a choice, you know, either it exports its oil at around $50 rather than $90, or it can just shut in its production and not export at all. But then you will lose $50, right? So, you know, you may want 90, but I'm offering you 50. Do you want it or not? And so you force the choice on Russia. Now, that there's no guarantee that Russia would make the choice of exporting, you know, 7.5 million barrels per day. They may choose to export something less than that. But today, what Russia is doing is to ship oil, let's say, from the Baltic ports, instead of to Europe, which is much closer by, going to ship it to India three times farther away, which means that it ties up three times as many tankers as it otherwise would, right? So this market distortion today is leading to a lot of economically inefficient trade, which if you are concerned about energy efficiency and climate change, you shouldn't want to maintain indefinitely, right? So It's not different from the price cap idea in the sense of the result that you want to achieve, which is lower Russian oil income so that Vladimir Putin has less money to fight the war with. But it's much easier to execute as a policy because it's entirely within Western control. You don't need anyone else. The complication of executing a price cap policy concerns me because if something's very complicated, it may fall apart, right? So you're telling a Greek tanker owner that he can't trade in Russian oil and London won't insure the cargo. So what do people do? Do people sell the tankers to someone else? Did the Chinese, the Indians, and Russians figure out an insurance scheme that bypasses Western institutions? There are many things that people would do for money, right? Basically, if there's enough money, as I said, oil will move at the right price. And so, you know, I'm concerned about the United States as the leader of the coalition against Russia in the war, coming up with a policy that's been slow in getting off the mark. We still don't have the details, as I said, and may turn out to be ineffective.
When you talk about other countries playing along with this idea, also thinking about countries that most likely won't, or already are not and have actually increased imports, like you mentioned, China, India, but also Turkey, a NATO ally. What are the implications of Turkey? Do you see them continuing to increase their imports of natural gas and oil during this conflict? Or are they in a situation that they might come to a head soon?
Turkey's playing a very complicated game. It is in a position to import Russian oil and gas. It needs oil and gas imports. And if the Russians offer a good price, the question is, if you're Turkey, why wouldn't you buy it, right? The Turkish economy, by the way, is in terrible shape. So they need a lot of help. At the same time, Turkey is supplying drones to Ukraine. It wants to be an honest broker in terms of freeing up food exports out of Ukraine. So it's playing a multiple game. And I think the problem, the challenge is, how do you convince other countries who are not directly involved in the fight, and not just Turkey, that is in their interest to go along with something that the West wants to do for its own reasons, right? And I think we haven't, as we've seen in the G20 summit that just finished, that we haven't managed to do that. We haven't been able to convince the Chinas, the Indias, the Indonesias, and other countries of the world that this is their fight also. Food exports is an interesting angle in this, actually. As you know, up until recently, Russia have been blockading Ukrainian ports. Ukraine is a big exporter of grain and fertilizer, by the way, but mostly grain, and there's a food shortage around the world. So again, my view is that there is no substitute for hard military power. So one of the things that we did during the Iran-Iraq war was that the U.S. Navy and the British Navy, by the way, escorted oil tankers from Kuwait out of the Persian Gulf. I don't understand why we haven't already proposed to do that in the Black Sea, escorting Ukrainian grain exports so that they would not be subject to attack by the Russian military or suffer under a Russian naval blockade. You could actually maybe get Turkey on side of that. Now, Turkey does control the Bosphorus, right? And there are international conventions that governs the Bosphorus, so you would need Turkey's cooperation. But certainly freedom of navigation in the Black Sea is in Turkey's national interest. As you said, as you pointed out, Turkey is a NATO ally. What if NATO were to escort Ukrainian grain exports out? That would send a signal to Russia. Now, again, this is hard military power I'm talking about. You know, just like I was before, when I talked about no-fly zone, that's hard military power. The only way of deterring another military at a time of war is hard military power. Economic sanctions, in theory, may work, but they would take a long, long time. And it's not a substitute for hard military power. And I think this is an important question for students in security studies to think about. Given that there are certain policy objectives, including economic objectives, how do you use military power in a way that doesn't necessarily expand a war, but achieve your objectives within a reasonable period of time, rather than say, well, we're not going to put boots on the ground, so let's do economic sanctions just to show that we're doing something. There is kind of a vacuous element to saying that economic sanctions by themselves would stop the war. They almost never have in the past, in human history. So what makes us think that it will be different this time? So, you know, I think it's important to understand economic sanctions and any sanctions and how it plays out in this war. But if I were to leave you one message at all, it would be that there is no substitute for hard power.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Chow, for coming in today and for talking to us about this. We really appreciate it and just really appreciate your time and your expertise on this. And I know a lot of people will be excited to hear your perspective.
Thank you very much. Thank you both.
As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are the views of the participants alone and do not represent the views or opinions of Georgetown University, the Precision Guided Podcast, or any other agency. Thank you for listening to the Precision Guided Podcast. Follow the Georgetown Security Studies Review on social media to stay up to date on the latest Precision Guided Podcast episodes and GSSR content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, or you can visit our website at georgetownsecuritystudiesreview.org. We'd like to thank Connor Thode for editing this episode. Thank you to all of our listeners out there. This is the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review.